There's probably no subject that is more difficult to appreciate on a popular level than this rather dry and dismal problem of logic. Logic is an offense to most people because they much prefer to be illogical. They find logic a very frustrating thing, and the definitions available in dictionaries and standard reference works are either inadequate or utterly confusing. Yet actually, logic can be a very interesting subject if we begin to apply it to ourselves or try to gain some practical insight about the processes of the human mind. If we possess essential facts, there would be little use for either logic or reason. In fact, most of the branches of learning that we know today would be useless if we had a small group of inevitable, eternal facts available to our comprehension. We use the word fact today rather loosely. We use it to define anything which seems to be obviously and undeniably true. And we do have a small number of what might be termed trite facts. Facts that no one will ever question, but in themselves will contribute very little to our improvement, our happiness, or our security. Thus, there are so-called self-evident things which no one chooses to question or deny. Every once in a while, however, someone assails one of these self-evident things and has demonstrated that many of them can be successfully assailed. For example, it was a self-evident fact in the 13th and 14th century that the earth was flat. No one questioned it. Today, in the 20th century, we know the earth is geographically round and financially flat. But that is a little different from the original thinking. We know that people were burned at the stake, boiled in oil, ridiculed, and persecuted for affirming things that we now call to be facts. This can only have one essential meaning to us, namely that even obvious facts may not be factual. Realizing, as we must in philosophy, that we are dealing with a universe of values, most of these values essentially unknown, we must develop various means of self-orientation. If we cannot know that which is inevitably and eternally true, then we must deal with probabilities. We must deal with those beliefs and convictions and policies and attitudes which seemingly have the greatest amount of integrity and veracity in them. Logic comes to our aid in this particular type of emergency. Logic helps us to escape the tendency to develop what Epictetus calls a falling sickness of the mind. It prevents us from being imposed upon by common or vulgar errors. It prevents us from overlooking the more obvious hazards, difficulties, or inconsistencies in reports and so-called facts. Logic is of two kinds, generally broadly divided between pre-Aristotelian logic and post-Aristotelian logic. Post-Aristotelian logic was a systematic science of logic, built up by a very careful classification of processes and procedures and the perfection of logical instruments by means of which we were able to refine to certain measure those common processes which we know as common sense. Logic was really formalized to press forward the conclusions of the individual on matters which he commonly regarded as normal, reasonable, probable, likely. Pre-Aristotelian logic was called natural logic. And natural logic is part of the wisdom of the folk. Natural logic is the shrewdness of the old farmer, the almost untutored skill of the village lawyer. At a time when books were few, problems were rather simple, the lawyer depended largely upon common sense, and so did the judge. In those days, the confusion of litigation as we know it today did not exist. And for the most part, justice was discovered by simple, rather ordinary procedures. Natural logic also helped the semi-civilized person to come to certain conclusions that were consistent with his general attainment. Natural logic, therefore, must have some bearing upon the capacity of the person to be logical. It was not a formal structure that could be passed on from one person to another and be universally true for all concerned. It was a kind of homely insight that developed around the natural thoughtfulness, the natural penetration of certain minds that seemed to have special abilities in being thoughtful or reasonable or sequential or orderly in their thinking. Thus, in most communities, there were a few logical persons who were greatly called upon for their advice, their opinions on various matters of significance. Perhaps the most useful phase of logic for us is that it is related to the science of the reasonable. In every contact we have in life, we are challenged to determine within ourselves the reasonableness of situations. We are required to determine the reasonableness of the news that we read in the paper, the reasonableness of the explanations given to us by friends and associates for their various activities. We are expected also to be able to defend in a reasonable manner our own feelings, our own beliefs, our own attitudes on a variety of common issues. The enemy of the reasonable, of course, is not just merely thoughtlessness. It is largely pressure. One of the most common causes of unreasonableness is the desire of the person, we will say, to get something for nothing. This is a common affliction of our race. And never have we suffered from it more than at the present time. Never have we been so gullible. Never have we been so over-influenced by pretension. Never have we lost our common sense in the desperate desire to have things the way we want them to be, regardless of whether the way is reasonable or not. Logic is part of philosophy because it has to depend upon the development of certain philosophical instruments in consciousness. The person to be logical must have some framework or background of reasonableness. He must have some foundation in natural law. He must have some comprehension of the probabilities of existence. And having gained a basic knowledge of such principles, he must have the courage to apply them. And he must also have the memory necessary to bring them to attention at the proper time. Perhaps one of the simplest examples of this that we can advance quickly is the problem of Buddhist philosophy. Here we have a very complicated system which has passed through numerous reformations and changes based upon two laws, the law of causality, or cause and effect, and the law of rebirth, or reincarnation. To the Buddhist, these are real fixed points in thought. He builds his entire concept of life around them. Under the law of cause and effect and its manifestation as karma, he has been taught that he is not ever going to get something for nothing. He accepts this. He accepts it not only as a philosophical truth, as an ethical fact, as a moral reality, but as a spiritual inevitable. Now, we cannot say that it is possible to demonstrate to the ultimate degree of finality the factualness of the Buddhist position. We can accept it, we can reject it, we can admire it, we can dislike it. But we can only come to the point of saying that in the light of the structure of the philosophy itself, it is reasonable. Furthermore, in the light of human experience, it is reasonable. After all, we have all tried to get something for nothing. We have found it one of the most expensive procedures that there is. We have been disillusioned, deceived, and cheated hundreds of times in our efforts to build a universal value called a bargain. We know in our heart of hearts and our mind of minds that real bargains are extremely rare, and that to discover them at all requires a great deal of judgment. They can occur, but only under the most fortuitous circumstances. Thus, in the Buddhist concept, the individual is not looking for a bargain. If something comes to him a little more easily than might seem to be normally the probability, he begins to call on another one of his laws, or another phase of his law, to express this or to understand it, and that is the law of karma. He decides that perhaps he has earned a little better destiny than he thought, and therefore occasionally something unusually pleasant or agreeable occurs to him. On the general pattern, however, of a universe built upon the law of cause and effect, it is not difficult to build a fairly solid structure of logic. Nor is it so difficult to be logical about the life of the person if we accept the idea of reincarnation. But these are merely two examples, not to press the point, not to affirm that these are the best of all beliefs, but merely to point out that the individual, in order to develop logic, must have certain basic beliefs. He must have certain concepts that are large enough to satisfy him that they are true. And then he must apply to these the various developments of reasoning powers and experiences which occur, fitting that which happens into the pattern of that which he believes to be a reasonable universal plan. If he is able to do this, of course, he is protected against a great deal of imposition. And he is able to be logical in the terms of the basic beliefs that he holds. And this, of course, is more or less as far as logic can go. Logic is a way of proving a certain conviction, but it is not a way of proving that the conviction itself is true. Logic is to unfold a thing according to its premise. If it is consistent with its premise, it is logical. But this does not mean that it must be factual. But today, most people have fairly good premises. They move from reasonably well-developed common attitudes. These premises have been strengthened by education. They have been strengthened by the historical experience of our race, by tradition, by observation, by experimentation, and by what we term authority, which I regard as about the least of all, but it's still there. These foundations are available to us, and we can build logically in harmony with them. Also, we know that for a thing to be logical, there must be a relation between what happens to us and what happens to other people. Now, here is a bad example of logic. It is logical that good should come to us because we deserve it. It is illogical that good should come to others because they do not deserve it. Our assumption in this always is that we, by nature, are superior to others. That while it is perfectly reasonable and perfectly probable for another individual to be victimized by poor judgment, this is just not possible to us. We have a kind of infallibility in us. We can say, when someone else is in trouble, it serves him right. But when the same trouble comes to us, to borrow a line from Kipling, the bottom is out of the universe. We no longer have any faith in anything. Thus, we are unable to realize or to admit that we all have the same fallibilities, that we are all subject to the same mistakes, and that therefore we have no right and no reason to assume that any attitude that we possess gives us immunity to the common events of life. So logic can help us. It can help us to build a universe around certain concepts. And certainly the law of cause and effect is one of these concepts. It is a concept that if we want something, we must earn it. And also that if we want a dollar, we must earn a dollar, not 50 cents. It is a concept that what we earn will ultimately come to us. And then we go into another level of logic. And we say to ourselves, what is the meaning of the whole concept of earning and paying? Certainly, we work hard. We gain certain goods or chattels for our labor. These goods we spend or trade or do something with to gain other ends that we want. But what is the meaning of it all? After a lifetime of barter and exchanging, we depart into a universe which, according to the opinions of our philosophers and theologians, will not be devoted to bartering and exchanging. That most of the things we do here are peculiarly related to this kind of life. So it is perfectly reasonable to ask the question, why do we spend 70 years here doing things we may never do again? Now, this is a kind of a sticky question. Now, if we're materialists, there is no answer. There's not only no answer, but there's no reason why we should have lived here in the first place. If we are theologians and believe that we are going to drift off into some paradisical abode where we will spend eternity with the angels, this may also be optimism, but it gives us no real incentive for becoming skillful merchants, good mechanics, does not even give us any particular reason for any art unless it be music, and we are stuck with a harp sometimes. But outside of this, there is no reason for it. Rebirth tells us, well, perhaps we'll come back and need these skills again. But the question then naturally arises, how many of these skills will be in survival by the time we come back? Will we be working hard to perfect a capitalistic system to find that we return 1,000 years from now and capitalism is extinct? What do we know about these things? So we ask ourselves all kinds of questions, children ask. We do not know the absolute answer. We hope we have a reasonable answer. But if someone turns around, picks a hole in our answer, and discomforts us because we are unable to demonstrate our point, then we have been deficient in logic in the development of our solution or our approach to the matter. We have to have not only things that are reasonable, but things which can be demonstrated or manifested to the best of our rational ability. So logic is the means by which we put our ideas into neat little packages, label them, and have them available when we need them. Ideas which will influence us and which we can communicate in an articulate manner to others. This is especially a responsibility of parents to children. The answers that they give children must be logical, and they must be reasonable. The child may not be able to distinguish the reasonable elements, but most children can discover the lack of logic, and they will turn right around and ask the inevitably embarrassing question. This type of thing discomforts parents, but what it should point out to the parent is that he never had the answer, and that his own need is as great as that of the child. He has been drifting along without any clear, reasonable explanation for the very problem the child is bringing to attention. And it's very apt to be a key problem, a basic problem, and a very valuable one. So logic inspires the person to make sure that his own answers, his own thinking, his own solution to problems are not only reasonable, but in the lines of consistency are defensible in a world of doubting friends, relatives, and neighbors. The problem of logic means that we must face the logic of other people. They tell us something we disagree with. There is no use in disagreeing. There is no use in shouting. There is no use in sulking. We must have a better answer, or the other person's logic stands, whether we like it or not. If he is logical, if he has developed his premises correctly, if we are unable to find any flaw in the unfoldment of his basic ideas, then we must either agree with him or become better students ourselves, in order that we may find flaws that normally we would overlook. So that logic helps us to straighten out, clarify, simplify, and direct both thought and word. Logic helps us to put into a concise statement our ideas about a matter. One thing we observe in logical people is that they very often lack imagination. That they are perhaps too concise, that they are uninteresting because they approach everything in such a peculiarly realistic way that they manage to take most of the romance and drama out of life. This, again, is because they have had too much Aristotelian logic and have never found that the development of the logical faculty is a very beautiful, interesting, dramatic, dynamic thing. They have become logy in it. They have become bound by rules only, until the rules have become more important than the ideas. All rules exist merely in order to clarify ideas. The rule is not the important thing. It is merely that the frame by means of which the picture gains new dignity. And to substitute the rule for the picture, or the frame for the picture, is to become a pedant, to become this type of mind that was so criticized in the Middle Ages, which we call today the scholastic, and which at an earlier time the Greeks called sophists, meaning today, in our thinking, those pedants whose knowledge was more apparent than real. Logic in our daily working with problems can always gain some help by the generalization of particular ideas. today we have to realize that we live in a world with billions and 3 billions of other people. And therefore, that in some way, any attitude that we have, any belief that we hold, must have a fairness about it, must have a larger integrity in it. It cannot be a private idea. We cannot live in private worlds ruled over by a private set of laws which we have invented, defended by a small army consisting only of our own faculties, and perpetuated regardless of the evidence against it that may accumulate in the world around us. We cannot have these private worlds. When we are unable to be big enough and broad enough to escape from these private worlds, we retire into them under pressure and become introverts. Very often the introvert is simply a person who does not want to live in the world as it is, but in a private universe of his own. Now, if he stays there, refuses to come out, he may remain in this private universe for his entire lifetime. He may populate it with his own kind of gods and godlings. He may make his own rules to run it. He may decree who he will permit and who he will not permit to be a citizen of his private world. In the end, however, he generally has no citizens but himself. This kind of attitude, while perhaps not carried to this extreme, is a common failing. We like to feel a certain power to interpret things as we want to. This is all right up to a certain point. Beyond that, it is a form of self-hypnosis or self-over-suggestion in which we gradually force a dignity upon our opinions which they do not really deserve. So we have to say to ourselves when we take attitudes, what would happen if these attitudes became general? Immanuel Kant, in his Categorical Imperative, gives us a good example of this policy. He tries to place a criterion upon man's concepts and precepts. He says, for example, that the final test of everything is that a belief of ours, fully matured and developed and unfolded according to all of its potential, if the code by which we live, the production of our own thinking and feeling, if this code became universal and all men had to live under this exact code, would there be universal justice? If there isn't, then our own code is wrong. In other words, if our code is not a code that we could live under, if it was administered by another person rather than ourselves, then things are not good with us. If we cannot create a way of life which is fair to all men, it is not fair to us. And it may be an expedient thing which we cannot immediately change, but it is not an ultimate, nor is it something greatly to be desired. We must always attempt the universalization of our attitude to see whether we would like to live under such a system. This is almost another statement of the Golden Rule, which occurs in over 40 religions and philosophies. It is simply a statement of the idea that would we really want others to do to us what we are moved to do to them? If we feel like taking advantage of them, would we be just as happy if they took advantage of us in the same way? If we would not, then we shouldn't start it, because the law of cause and effect will move in. So logic finally helps us to live in such a way that we can be happy under the law of cause and effect. It teaches us to sow wisely in order that we may reap happily. It tells us to plant what we expect to harvest, and that we will not have a harvest contrary to the planting. It also warns us to guard the crop carefully during the difficult periods of its growth. For if we neglect the harvest, we will diminish the fullness thereof. It places the universe under a pattern of law. If we do not want to be lied to, we do not lie. If we do not want to be exploited, we do not exploit. If we do not want to be deceived, we do not deceive. If we do not want to be neglected, we do not neglect. We take it for basic fact, as far as we are able to extend fact, that it is extremely logical and reasonable that the things that we do will have inevitable consequences in us, and we must be prepared to live by them. Now, why and how shall we demonstrate this? Logic again comes forward. If we assume this concept of sowing and reaping to be just, how can we logically defend it? We can defend it in a great many ways. We can defend it in the common ground of all logic. First, we can defend it mentally. For we are able to prove by straight thinking that this is true injustice. This is true in man-made law. This is true in every experience that we know. We gain further support from it by the observation of natural phenomena around us. We observe the various habits of creatures. We recognize the wisdom of the ancient saying, waste not, want not. We know that this is part of the folk wisdom of our people. History can give us terrible examples of those who have broken these simple rules. So by degrees, we build up a very powerful defensive structure. This is not pure logic, but this is what might be termed natural logic. It is the kind of logic which guided the conduct of our ancestors. We can, however, by the skillful use of words, formularize all these facts into simple, direct statements. These direct statements appear in themselves to be beyond controversy. They cannot be denied. The sequence of them must therefore come to a reasonable and inevitable conclusion, and that conclusion is logical. Now, there's no reason why everyone should spend the rest of their time trying to work out logical theorems or make use of the Aristotelian categories in order to arrive at certain conclusions that they want. The problem is largely the preservation in modern man of natural logic. The simple homespun variety, the kind that is the wisdom of the young which will confound the old on many occasions. We can gradually develop a kind of common sense which, if we are mindful of it and continuously live according to it, will take out of our lives many of the unpleasant incidents with which we are afflicted. We can remember certain very simple formulas in the working of these problems. We can say to ourselves, a certain man has cheated us. This man, in turn, has cheated others. And we must therefore come to the logical conclusion that he is not honest. And on the basis of this conclusion, we must be on guard against him at all times. Now, this is not so difficult if we are quiet and in an impersonal mood, but you'd be surprised at the stream of younger people who come to me who have made illogical marriages. Not because they were not students of Aristotle, but because they lacked ordinary common sense. A person under the glamour of romance, for example, will come and tell me frankly that she has become smitten by a young man who has been for years a chronic alcoholic. This individual has never been able to keep a job, and he has a bad police record. But she feels that in spite of all this, he is a good man, basically, and that she is going to be able to reform him in 10 easy lessons. Now, by this we have a good example of bad logic. She is not going to accomplish such a thing. The testimonies are against her. The testimonies indicate that in her emotional attachment, she has lost sight of nearly all of the essential facts. Another individual comes to me with a business problem. He has a man with whom he is closely associated in business. In a number of personal affairs which have arisen in their lives, matters largely of friendship or social relations or incidental things, the man who came to me learned several matters about his business associate. First, he learned that he was a tax evader. He learned that he chiseled in every way possible and was perfectly willing to perjure himself on his tax returns. But my friend said, well, after all, taxes are not very fair, so I don't blame him. Maybe I'd do the same thing. A little later, he found that this man had a beautiful congenital habit of lying. Whenever he was in a difficulty, he lied. When he didn't want to do something, he lied. The lies were mostly comparatively harmless. They were just nice little white lies, but they were getting a little gray with constant wear. He also found out that this individual was perfectly willing to drive a sharper bargain than the facts justified. That this individual was perfectly willing to misrepresent products. He was perfectly willing to promise delivery of goods that he could not deliver. Not because he wasn't supported and backed by the firms with whom he dealt, but he knew they were slow of delivery. He knew that he could not promise these things, yet he promised, fully aware that he could not keep his word. Little by little, the man who came to me got an impression of this man that was pretty bad. But after having this impression built up and sustained for several years, he was never able to understand why this man suddenly cheated him. There was just no other probable outcome. Logically, reasonably, this man would ultimately cheat anybody for the fact that he had this kind of a basic disposition. But because he was friendly, because he was affable, because he was good-intentioned, apparently, the people with whom he dealt were off guard and were seriously imposed upon. Now, anyone who has the tendency to think straight can avoid these kinds of problems. He can also avoid problems of excessive debt. He can guard against allowing his emotions or his appetites to cause him to take on unreasonable responsibilities that he cannot meet. If he sat down and figured out the law of probabilities, he would be in a much stronger position than he is under his present way of thinking. One man came to me who had a little more of the logical attitude within himself. I think he wanted me to help him to be illogical, but I couldn't oblige. What he was explaining to me was that he was buying a house. Actually, he was buying a house that was way out of his financial class. He was buying a house, and he sat down with me and he figured it out. He says, it is going to take me 20 years to pay for this house. And in order to pay for it, and to maintain my family in a reasonable security. I cannot be sick for one day or out of work for one day in that entire period of time. Is it probable that I can make this transaction safely? The answer, of course, it isn't. It isn't so. He would have some backlog to protect him. If this man had enough additional funds to maintain himself for 2 years, at any time during the period under consideration, he might have taken the chance. As it was far too dangerous. Yet most people would never stop and think of this. They think of only the refinancing, or the possibility of bluffing their way through, or the even more dangerous situation of ending up with various indebtedness on which they're paying from 12 to 20% per annum. People just will not sit down and quietly put two and two together and get four as a result. So if we can train minds just a partial way along this thinking things through policy, then we find that there are many simple rules, simple guides, simple ways by which we can protect ourselves against unusual and unreasonable stress. Wherever we do not make this protective move, where we do not think these things through, we hazard not only our security, our happiness, our friends, but we also hazard our health. The individual, having made unreasonable moves and forced to defend them in one way or another, may pay with his life for the additional anxiety that he has brought upon himself. So the philosophical pattern here, the great value of philosophy, is that it shall cause prudence, that it will not restrict the person in the reasonable fulfillment of reasonable desires, but will prevent him from taking on unreasonable futures which he may not be able to meet. This philosophical pattern will prevent him from mortgaging years that are not yet his. These principles will help him to be able to sit down quietly and reason through the intensities of his own desires, reason through the pressures of his own ambitions, and try to arrive at a course of action which is defensible in terms of common sense. If he can do this, he will not have too many difficulties. So what we call natural logic is that the person shall have normal expectancy as to the outcome of the various things or patterns with which he is concerned. He will set something in motion with a full awareness of the responsibilities and the opportunities. That he will accept debt advisedly, knowing that sometimes he must accept it. But he will never abuse the privilege of owing money. He will never go so far in a situation that he endangers all because he must have something. This type of discipline takes philosophy out of the realm of abstraction where we have tried to keep it in the cloistered sanctuaries of universities and puts it to work where it belongs, in the daily existence of individuals who must defend themselves in this particular generation against a wild array of illogical and unreasonable pressures. The individual must become more quiet as the world becomes noisier. He must become more careful as the world grows more careless. He must compensate for every dereliction of society by a further intensification of his own integrity. Otherwise, he is ultimately going to be drowned in a sea of common mistakes. Now, when we come to sum up this problem of logic and of the reasonable, we must naturally fall with it into the next branch of philosophical study, and this is ethics. Now, ethics is concerned primarily with two problems, but before we approach them directly, we know that ethics must seek the definition of morality. Ethics has to do with the nature of moral good and moral bad. Now, this problem is hardly less complicated than the one involving logic. And it is somewhat more difficult because good and bad emotionalize so rapidly and rationalize so slowly. The whole problem of good and bad is extremely relative and has been subject to more ramifications and changes in the course of human history than perhaps any other basic concept. However, in the basic definition, morality must be that by means of which individual conduct contributes the most to collective security. Morality must have to do with the individual's concept of what is right. And what is right must be a positive statement of value. Morality then does break down into the two divisions which I mentioned. Morality being, first of all, what is the present good? How are we to approach the problem of contemporary value? But morality goes a step beyond this. For morality must define the nature of future good, because it is only by the definition of future good that civilization grows. Without a vision of something better than it is, everything fails. Thus, we must have not only a nature of good as we know it, but of better as it could be, or as the future naturally implies, a reasonable growth. This growth being a growth not only in estate, but in value. So we can say that ethics has to do with the basic problem of value. It has to do with decision as to that which is most necessary and the greater good. And it therefore is the type of decision which may cause the patriot to sacrifice his life for his principle. It may cause the parent to sacrifice more slowly the years of life for the protection of the child. It may be the conviction which causes the person to depart from worldliness, dedicate himself to some missionary endeavor, and bury his life in some jungle or swamp. These are values. Values which we find expressed on every level of human activity. So we now consider first the problem of ethics as an effort to determine the nature of morality. Now, today we think of morality almost entirely on the emotional level of physical human relationships. This is not according to philosophy. Morality, according to philosophy, is actually motivation. Morality is the reason behind conduct. And whatever we do, are we motivated by the principle powers or values that we associate with ethics? Are we motivated by integrity? Are we motivated by virtue? Are we motivated by the fact that what we plan to do is necessary, useful, proper, and therefore generally commendable? Morality includes the element of mental and emotional integrity and physical honesty. Honesty is the long physical shadow of integrity. And many persons who are honest from fear only. They are not persons of basic integrity. Morality, then, has to do with whether or not we shall compromise value for any reason, for any consideration. Logic would say, don't compromise it because it is unreasonable. Ethics would say, do not compromise because compromise is not good. We move now from the standard of the reasonable and the practical to the standard which is largely dominated by the function of the human conscience. Good becomes to the individual his standard of action. If his standard of action is too low, then it is obvious through his conduct because he is not good. So each person has to determine in his own way a standard of morality. And it will involve a large number of different activities. One of the most common decisions he has to make is the degree to which he will compromise integrity to utility. This is the great question of today. It is a question that is faced in every field of human activity. It is faced by everyone seeking employment. It is faced by nearly everyone who has a job. It is a decision that comes frequently into the home. It has much to do with the fact we have or do not have friends. And it may have a great deal to do with the bank balance. These problems are problems of ethics, and they are problems which involve primarily the degree to which we are willing to sacrifice advantage to the maintenance of principle. Well, this question is open to very large debate. The general tendency of people today is to give it less and less attention, and a person will consider himself as reasonably virtuous if he is as honest as conditions permit. And, of course, with conditions permitting less and less, he is not gaining very much in moral stature with the passing of time. Now, each person has the decision to make, and the problem of the ethical life of the individual is summed up in philosophy in a very simple manner. And yet this simple manner is far greater instrument than we realize. Namely, that each individual must live in a way in which he can live with himself without stress. This does not mean that all persons are going to be able to make all ethical adjustments immediately. To the average person, the problem of ethics and the problem of morality, both are related to a relationship between the individual and his own life. For example, a person belonging to a religious group may be instructed by this group, as some are, that it is a moral sin to turn on a television, a radio. It is a moral sin to go to a theater or a dance. And it is a moral sin to read romantic or non-religious literature. That puts the lid down pretty tight on this person. So his problem then is, how does he feel about it? If he has assumed this faith, if he is convinced that the faith is true, if he has voluntarily committed himself to what he regards as the deepest religious principles that are possible to him, he is, by this act, committing himself to the rules of that organization or group. If he is sincere, whether he is reasonable or not, if he is devout, whether he is sensible or not, he cannot break the rules which he affirms to be true without damage to his own character. This is the inevitable product of the conflict in ethical standards. It means, therefore, that anything of a moral nature which offends the individual is going to damage him.